Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. No matter where you're listening, around the world, this is Sedona Talk Radio.
Welcome to Dispelling the Myths. This is your host, Kalia LaRoche. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen today, whether you're here with us for the live show or listening at a later time. If you're joining us live and feel inspired to ask questions, we'll normally be taking calls. Now, I've got an issue going on right now. Our guest is supposed to be Sam Vaknin, author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. However, Sam Vaknin is, he's somewhere in Greece, and I'm having a hard time getting a hold of him. So I was unable to connect with him before the show. So what I'm going to do is play some music for you for just a second and see if I can't get him on the line. So if you'll hang tight with me for just a minute. Thank you. Okay, and we are back, and we have Sam Vaknin with us. Are you with us, Sam?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on your show.
Great, and thank you for being here. And I thank you all who are listening for your patience and sticking with me and listening to some music. That was a portion of my song, Dance of Angels, that you were listening to. So now we are on to another interesting topic, which is narcissistic personality disorder. And I've had lots of shows in this series on narcissistic personality disorder. So our guest today is Sam. A lot of you probably already know who he is. He's a man who's been diagnosed as having narcissistic personality disorder and went on to write about it from an inner perspective. And anyone who has done any internet research on the topic at all will know of Sam Bachman, who offers incredible insight into the mind of a narcissist. Am I saying your name right, Sam?
Yeah, Sam Bachman is fine.
Okay.
Happens to be my last 47 years.
Okay. A lot of people have a hard time pronouncing my name, Kalia, so I have great respect for trying to get people's name right.
Right.
So, and Sam, you're also the author of the book Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited, which is a work of reference about narcissistic personality disorder.
That's true.
So, could you tell us, Sam, how you got to this point where you are now one of the largest, I call it internet presences, on the topic of narcissism? How did this all start for you? How did you get to the point where you were diagnosed?
Well, I was diagnosed actually twice.
Uh-huh.
I was diagnosed once in Canada, having broken up with my fiancé, or rather having been dumped by my fiancé in London. I suggested to her to try couple therapy with a therapist in Canada. We flew back and forth from London to Canada. At that time I had a lot of money. And the therapist finally diagnosed me with narcissistic personality disorder, which pretty much convinced my fiancé that it's a hopeless case, and we broke up. The second time was quite a few years later, I think, 8 years later, when I was in jail. I was imprisoned for securities fraud, a very hot topic nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So I cornered the market in some stocks, and I used the illicit or illegal proceeds to purchase a bank in Israel, and that was quite a chaotic situation. At any rate, I was indicted and then convicted for securities fraud, and I was sentenced to 3 years in prison, of which I've served one. And during my incarceration, I was offered a deal. If I was willing to submit to psychotherapy, I would be released on probation, on parole. And so I did. I went to see a psychiatrist, quite a bizarre figure. He cut quite a bizarre figure. He was an Orthodox Jew and a settler and an extreme right-winger and what have you, everything that I was not. But we got along and finally diagnosed me with the narcissistic personality disorder for the second time, which for me clinched the deal. I mean, having been diagnosed twice, I was pretty certain that
that's what was going on with you.
Yeah.
How long of a process were you with this second psychiatrist? How long were you with him before you made that diagnosis?
No, diagnosing the narcissistic personality disorder is a matter of hours.
They're pretty
powerful tools, for instance, the narcissistic personality inventory test,
mm-hmm.
and others, which allow a qualified diagnostician to diagnose NPD within hours, literally. Narcissism also constitutes a segment of bigger, larger tests, personality tests, such as the MMPI and so on. So diagnosing was not the issue. The issue is what to do once the diagnosis was in. NPD, narcissism, is considered to be rather untreatable. Certain behaviors can be modified. Social adaptation could be achieved to some extent. But the problem, the underlying, the root problem, is considered to be untreatable. So then there was a question of a treatment plan, treatment alliance, and so on. Anyhow, having been released in 1996, I moved to another country, and while I was in prison, I researched the topic. Books were smuggled in for me, notepads. Everything was illegal there. I was in a maximum security prison. But I even gained access to a computer, believe it or not. Finally, I succeeded to home in on information on NPD, and when I exited, I was shocked to discover that throughout the internet, there were only 150 pages dedicated to narcissism. The first website ever created for narcissism was the famous website by Joanna Ashman, still an excellent website.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the only one of any breadth and length.
And what year is this that you're talking about?
97,
okay.
So then I decided to place my entire... By that time, I have written a manuscript, a book, about narcissistic personality disorder, and I decided to place the entire text online. To the best of my knowledge, it was among the first cases of a commercial book being placed full text online. And I was overwhelmed with the responses. Hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of responses. I didn't know what to do. I opened mailing lists and support groups and discussion groups, and within months, they would swell to thousands of members. And I realized that narcissism is a serious, underdiagnosed, unnoticed problem.
Mm-hmm.
I also, of course, could not, it didn't escape the economic ramifications of this, did not escape my attention. I realized I could make money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So out of a combination of monetary motives, the overwhelmingly monetary motives, and the wish to garner narcissistic supply, attention in other words,
mm-hmm.
I became a ubiquitous internet presence. And well into 2004 or 5, I maintained dozens of websites, support groups, mailing lists, and so on and so forth. Since then, narcissism has become a back burner issue for me. But for well over 7 or 8 years, it's been the main thing in my life.
So are most of the people that are attracted to your site, do you find that they are actually victims of narcissistic abuse, or do you get a good percentage of people that are actually diagnosed or think that they have narcissistic personality disorder themselves?
For every 100, I get about 20 emails a day. So for every 100 emails, about one would be from someone who thinks that he's a narcissist. He. Usually it's a he.
Mm-hmm.
That he's a narcissist. So we are talking about one to 100. Well, that's also the ratio in the general population. It is now believed to be between 0.5% to 1% of the general population. So it's a pretty representative sample. The other 99 are victims of abuse. Now, not every abuser is a narcissist. Narcissism is a very convenient label,
mm-hmm.
and many victims of abuse tend to diagnose... quote-unquote, diagnose their hated ones as narcissists. Narcissism, pathological narcissism, and especially the narcissistic personality disorder, which is at the very extreme of the spectrum of narcissism, can be diagnosed only by a qualified diagnostician who administers a series of tests, questionnaires, and interviews. It cannot be diagnosed by victims of abuse, no matter how vehement and how sure they are of themselves. But
and yet, the victims of abuse, even if they don't have a diagnosis for their, you call them hated ones, I might call them loved ones, whatever they are, they are still getting relief by having some kind of a place to put these people in their lives.
Yes. Labeling and finding a handle on reality.
Mm-hmm.
However delusional the handle is, however wrong it is, however, you know, of course, labeling does confer relief on the victim. There's no question about it. But one would never diagnose another person with diabetes or with nephritis or with whatever without proper testing. And narcissistic personality disorder is not another phrase for jerk. It's a medical diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
and has to be medically diagnosed. I think the label abuser is sufficiently strong,
mm-hmm.
and without the need to classify them into psychopaths and narcissists and God knows what. So it's a bit unfortunate that there is this conflation of abusers and narcissists, because tactics that work with narcissists sometimes backfire with abusers of another kind. It could be dangerous.
Right.
If you misdiagnose an abuser and you apply coping techniques that work with narcissists, they may backfire if the abuser, for instance, is a psychopath. So it's a bit dangerous. It's a dangerous game. It's not only a question of, you know...
Because there's a fine line, isn't there, between narcissism and a sociopath. There's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, well, sociopaths and psychopaths are colloquial terms. The correct term is antisocial.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a fine line. You're absolutely right. And the DSM itself, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible of the psychiatric profession, makes very clear that the two are almost the same. The DSM, for instance, says that both narcissists, I'm quoting, both narcissists and psychopaths are tough-minded, glib, superficial, exploitative, and unempathic. But there are differences between narcissists and psychopaths that are crucial when it comes to how to cope with them. For instance, narcissists are not impulsive. Psychopaths are. Narcissists are far less aggressive than psychopaths. Narcissists are less deceitful. Psychopaths are far more deceitful.
Mm-hmm.
And narcissists usually are less criminalized, while psychopaths are criminals in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, and most importantly, psychopaths don't care about obtaining narcissistic supply. They are not about narcissistic supply. They are about manipulation or control. While narcissists are concerned mainly, or I would say exclusively, with obtaining or securing narcissistic supply. Attention, adulation, admiration, fear, notoriety, infamy, and so on, celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
So while the cars look the same, under the hood, the engine is different.
Right, right, and it can be dangerous if somebody doesn't realize that.
Yeah.
I would imagine mostly if they're physically abusive characteristics that they're experiencing, wouldn't you think, that would be the most dangerous time to make a misdiagnosis.
Yeah, well, a psychopath would tend to react to, where narcissists, for instance, would react to certain coping techniques, certain victim coping techniques, would react with the silent treatment or with devaluation or by walking away, the psychopath most likely will lash out aggressively and violently and break the victim's bones. That's dangerous.
So that's pretty serious.
Yeah.
Yet narcissistic people, or people with narcissistic personality disorder, have a lot of anger that is often repressed and comes up at the, you know, comes to the surface during things like narcissistic rage. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Yes. There are two schools, basically. One group of scholars believe that narcissism is a reaction to shame, a reaction to repressed shame. The narcissist as a child, or even as an infant, was subjected to humiliating experiences one way or the other, through abuse, abusive treatment, or by going through a trauma, or by being, even by being, you know, denigrated and berated by peers and role models. But anyhow, the narcissist went through a sequential experience of shame. In reaction to this, the narcissist as a child, as an infant, reacted with anger. However, because at that time the narcissist was, as I just said, a child, he, and more rarely she, was not able to express this anger, was not able to give an outlet to this anger. And so this anger bottled up. So the belief is that toxic anger, or what you just correctly called narcissistic rage, is a reaction to suppressed shame. That's one school. The second school believes that the narcissist's personality, self, is so chaotic, so disorganized, so primitive, and so precariously balanced that any criticism or disagreement, even or slight, real or imagined, are perceived to be an all-pervasive threat, a threat that endangers life itself. And so the reaction to any narcissistic injury reaction to any type of criticism, disagreement, slight, and so on, would be disproportional. That is what we call narcissistic rage, because the narcissist actually is not reacting to the disagreement or to the particular critical item or to the utterance, but the narcissist is reacting to his inner reality in which his very self could well disintegrate owing to the criticism. So narcissist reacts actually with panic. Narcissistic rage is a form of panic, a panic reaction. That's the second school of thought.
Now, which school of thought would you tend to agree with?
I think the second.
Mm-hmm.
I feel extremely threatened when I'm criticized or even when I feel injured, humiliated. I feel empty.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous painting by Dalí of a woman, I think, that sort of disintegrates into molecules. So I feel that I'm being molecularized. I feel I'm being reduced to molecules.
Kind of vaporized, in a sense, huh?
Yeah, vaporized, yeah. But the thing is that there are no gradations. The mildest criticism, the mildest disdain, the mildest disagreement would result with the same amount of rage and defiance on my part. I would react the same with the same intensity, with the same panic, with the same rage and even violence to the mildest form of criticism and to the most destructive form of disagreement.
So it doesn't really matter, it affects you the same. You still have the experience of being vaporized,
being
as I call it.
Yes.
So it's really just almost a feeling that you will die.
Yes,
that criticism equals death.
Yes.
And you think it's...
This is because I do not have a self. The only thing I have is a mask, a persona, what is called the false self in clinical terms. That's all I have. And if this is threatened, if this is about to be exposed, if this is about to be denigrated or debased or berated or chastised or whatever, then there's nothing behind it. You, normal people, can fall back on something. They can fall back on good childhood memories, on their parents' love, on their real self, the true self. They have something to fall back. Inside me, there's only a vacuum. I'm, in essence, a human shell. And shells are far more fragile than, you know, solid objects. So sometimes I withdraw socially. I become a hermit or a recluse. I withdraw in order to avoid even the possibility of being confronted with criticism and disagreement. Sometimes I'm afraid of my own rage, and so I try to avoid situations, because my rage, of course, is self-destructive and self-defeating in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I simply feign modesty and humility to mask my underlying grandiosity. I'm trying to project a falsely modest and you know, image, so as not to show the real monstrous me. So you see, there are numerous coping techniques, narcissistic coping techniques.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel that you came to this place? I was reading a little bit on your online journal about your childhood as what shaped you and created the narcissistic personality disorder in you. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, the fact is that I have been massively physically abused and psychologically abused until the age of 17. That's the fact. How this fact is correlated and related to the resultant personality disorder is still a matter of debate. There is a sizable group of scholars, I would say the majority, believe that recurrent abusive treatment and trauma, especially in early childhood and early adolescence, result in a series of mental health disorders and mainly personality disorders. There are others who say that the main problem would seem to be genetic. They point at the fact that, let's say, there's a family with five children, all of them have received the very same treatment, and only one of them has developed, let's say, NPD.
Right.
So they say, how come only one of them has developed NPD? It must be genetic. I think it's somewhere in the middle. I believe that some children are genetically predisposed to develop personality disorders and that the trigger is abusive treatment, as has been the situation in my case. I have never been sexually abused, but I have been horrendously physically and psychologically abused. I think most probably it had an impact, but the template was there. The genetic template must have been there, because, for instance, my sister hasn't reacted that way. Must have been something in me that sort of corresponded to this treatment.
Do you feel that it has, I mean, I know that there are plenty of women out there that have NPD. However, it seems that women have more of a tendency to become the victims and men to develop the narcissistic personality disorder. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Generally, victims of abuse, the majority of victims of abuse are women. That's a fact. Regardless of the personal and psychological composition of the abuser, vast majority of abuse victims are women. To start with, they are weaker and so physically weaker and so on. They are easy prey. It is also true that only one quarter of all people diagnosed with the narcissistic personality disorder have been or are women. The narcissistic personality disorder seems to be a male disorder. And I think this has to do with the fact that our society is narcissistic.
Absolutely.
Our society is competitive, encourages ambition, encourages a sense of entitlement, is very self-centered. Christopher Lash, in 1979, has written a book, The Culture of Narcissism. And since then, Theodor Millen and others have commented upon the fact that our civilization rewards, to a large extent, narcissistic behavior. We can see that in Wall Street, for instance, recently, rewards narcissistic behavior. And since ambition, conflict, competition, and so on are still, whether culturally or genetically, I'm not sure, are still male traits, males tend to be more narcissistic than females. Although the literature says, and I can quote, literature says that the male and female narcissists in general show striking similarities in the manner in which most of the facets of narcissism are integrated with each other. In other words, there are far fewer gender differences between males and females than we imagine. Still, the number of female narcissists is one-third the number of male narcissists, and I attribute it to our culture and civilization.
Right. And it's interesting how you brought up that we live in a narcissistic society, and it really doesn't seem to matter what country we're in. And I'm sure you have the same experience as I do, that people are writing to you from all English speaking, or I don't know if you're working in other languages, but for me, English speaking languages, anywhere that somebody speaks English, they're writing to me.
Yeah, well, Theodore Millen and Davies and other scholars claim that narcissism is far more prevalent in the United States and elsewhere. I do not think so. I would beg to disagree. I think narcissism is far less diagnosed in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no awareness of personality disorders, and because, I don't know if you know, but the narcissistic personality disorder is not a formal diagnosis, for instance, in Europe. Europe goes by another book called ICD, and the ICD is the European equivalent of the DSM, and in the ICD there is no diagnosis of NPD. There is no narcissism in the ICD, so there's no possibility even to diagnose it. China, as well, does not have narcissistic personality disorder. But having lived in 12 countries, and I speak 6 languages and correspond with people in 6 languages, I've lived in 12 countries, I can safely say, and 12 countries in 3 continents, I can safely say that there are narcissists absolutely everywhere, exactly as you say.
Yeah.
There are narcissists everywhere. And, hello?
Yes, and it's so interesting that you can communicate with people in 6 different languages. That really gives you an insight to just how much there is out there.
To some extent, although I must tell you, the world is so homogeneous today, It's such a McDonald's world, you know. It's dispiriting. I get letters from Arab countries, and I get letters from China, and get letters from Israel, and, you know, and they're all the same. They all read the same. Same experiences, same television series, same food, same fast food, same everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very dispiriting world, and I think this would tend to explain the resurgence and emergence of narcissism, because I think people feel, people want to be unique in an environment that renders them non-unique. In an environment where everything is absolutely the same, everyone has a MySpace website, everyone has a Facebook website, everyone has eats in McDonald's, and everyone drinks Coca-Cola, and everyone watches the same movies. In an environment where every person is interchangeable with every other person, being unique becomes an obsession. People want to declare their uniqueness. And inevitably, this strikes others as narcissism. I think narcissism is a reaction to the homogeneity of modern culture.
That's really interesting, and I tend to agree with that. That we really are, and I can only truly speak for the U.S., but in the United States, we're very much a self-serving nation. And we have very much self-serving politicians, and everything is self-serving. So it is really hard to live in a world where everybody is out for themselves,
yeah,
and try to carve somebody's unique place, to try to carve our unique place,
yeah,
in that world. So
narcissism is a declaration. It's a declaration of sorts. And that's why it's in fashion, by the way. I mean, there are websites which proclaim narcissism and brag about being narcissistic, and there's what I call a narcissistic swagger. You know, there's this, you know, look at me. What is social networking? But it's all narcissistic phenomena. Recently, a study has been released which identified narcissists, a plethora of narcissists, on Facebook. Social networking, to some extent, is a narcissistic phenomenon, and it's all because we have been reduced to atoms. We've been reduced to numbers. We have lost. There's a crushing weight of civilization that denudes us of our individuality, and we are screaming back and saying, "Hold it! You know, I'm special. I'm unique. It's me." And by doing so consistently and loudly, we actually are rendered narcissists.
By declaring our uniqueness too loudly.
By being obsessed with it, by compulsively declaring it,
mm-hmm,
by foregoing other things, by sacrificing other things just in order to be seen to be unique and special, to be noticed actually,
mm-hmm,
just in order to be noticed. There is an obsession with being noticed. This is what we call celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
An obsession with celebrity. Celebrity used to be confined to a very thin crust of society, but now there's instant celebrity, you know, American Idol, and this and that. There are other paths to celebrity, provided courtesy our society. And everyone is obsessed with being noticed, with celebrity, and or with notoriety. We have phenomena like serial killers, who are actually media figures. You know, they derive enormous pleasure from being from media coverage, from the media coverage. They try to attract attention to themselves, and so on. There are numerous studies about serial killers as narcissists, the narcissistic element in serial killing.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder the number of serial killers has gone up 30 times in the last 50 years.
Because it has something to do with their uniqueness, the serial killing, that not everyone's a serial killer, so that makes them stand out?
Yeah, it makes them stand out. They gain enormous media attention. Ultimately, they're exposed. There's even a hypothesis that they want to be caught, because by being caught, they can then attribute the deeds to themselves and sort of annex the notoriety. Usually, they're anonymous until they're caught. Once they're caught, they're no longer anonymous, and they become famous, you know.
Right.
Klebold is now famous. He has done nothing in his life except take life. But he's famous. place in history is guaranteed.
And that's a type of narcissism in itself, that one will take any type of attention, as negative as it might be.
Yeah, actually, one of the big mistakes of most scholars of narcissism, one of the big errors, is the belief that narcissists are out after positive attention.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you read textbooks, they say that narcissists are looking for adulation and admiration. Wrong. Narcissists are looking for attention. Whether the attention is, if they can garner positive attention, why not? But if they fail to garner positive attention because they don't have the necessary skills, or they are not very intelligent, or they are not very handsome, then they will garner negative attention. Notoriety is as good as being famous. Infamy is as good as being a celebrity. Being creative with one's victims is as good as many serial killers describe themselves as artists. So it's narcissistic supply isn't the drug of choice of the narcissist is called narcissistic supply.
Mm-hmm.
And narcissistic supply is about attention, positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
And that's what makes it dangerous. That's what makes it dangerous, is that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, sure.
If it was just about positive attention, then most narcissists would be on their best behavior.
Yeah, that's very true. So a narcissist that fails repeatedly and consecutively to secure positive supply would want to be feared, would induce fear in his victims. And fear would become the equivalent of admiration or adulation. And
what about power? Where does power come into play?
Well, power is a huge aphrodisiac and a great form of narcissistic supply, of course. It's power in itself, there's nothing wrong with power. Question is, what do you do with power? It's like a knife. Nothing wrong with a knife. Question, what do you do with it? So the pursuit of power in itself is not a pernicious phenomenon, not necessarily to be upbraided, but question is, what do you do with the power? And certain narcissists, when they attain power, they try to leverage their newfound capabilities to achieve things which are socially acceptable. Others abuse the power, or if they fail to use the power in productive ways, then they say, the hell with it, let me use the power in every which way, as long as the attention is secured. It's all about attention. You can get there through sex, you can get there through power, you can get there through being loved, you can get there through being feared.
Or hated, yes.
There is a million ways. Attention is it. How do you secure the drug? You can pay for it, you can murder for it, you can grow it in your backyard. Doesn't matter. It's the drug. Narcissists are drug addicts. Their drug is called narcissistic supply. They're junkies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, it almost seems, with what we've been talking about, that I want to say narcissism, but I know there's a fine line between narcissism and narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's so much more than 1%, or 1 out of 100. You said 1 out of 100. Is that what you said?
Not I, the literature.
The literature, okay. It seems that there's almost more than that when you look at how much you actually see of narcissism.
Well, there's narcissism and there's narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
As I said with my opening statement, so to speak.
Right.
NPD is a medical entity. It's a diagnosis akin to diabetes or cardiac arrest or whatever. And it's rare. It's rare because the DSM requires a confluence of at least 5 factors for a person to be diagnosed with. So, for instance, if you only lack empathy, it's not enough. If you only feel entitled to special treatment, as children do, it's not enough. That means there's a series of 9 criteria, and if you have 4 of them, you still don't qualify. You still don't have NPD. But if you're talking about narcissism, as a social behavioral set of traits, what Milon calls a narcissistic style, then yes, of course, I would say that 10 to 15% of the population would have that.
Right.
So yes. I suggest we make a distinction between NPD, which is a clinical thing, which is very rarely diagnosed because there needs to be, as I said, a confluence of traits and behaviors that, with such confluence, is rare. And narcissistic traits or narcissistic style, which are much more common, of course. So many people feel grandiose and self-important. Others are obsessed with fantasies of unlimited success or fame. Others are convinced that they're unique and special and can be understood or should be treated or associated with only with special high-status people. Some people require excessive admiration and attention. Others feel entitled. Some of them are exploitative. Others don't have empathy. Some are envious. Others are arrogant. You see, all these are traits, narcissistic traits.
You have to have the accumulation of all of them to have NPD.
Accumulation of five of these nine.
Five of these nine. And it's interesting, though, that we were talking about people self-diagnosing their partners.
Yeah.
By looking at the list of criteria and saying, oh yeah, he does that, he does that, he does that, he does that, he does that. Oh my God, my life finally makes sense. It finally makes sense. And I think that that's where a lot of people are coming from. It's not so much an official diagnosis, but it's more putting it into a box that makes sense for people.
Yes, the motivation of victims live in a totally chaotic and unpredictable world. Their world is shattered by abusive treatment.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency from childhood to believe in the goodness of people, to believe that the world is predictable, and to believe in a system of rewards for good behavior and proper conduct. Abusive treatment shatters all this. Abusive treatment is unpredictable. It is unfair, and it is threatening. So victims of abuse are enormously disoriented. They seek meaning. Their world has been rendered meaningless by the abusive treatments. There are no longer guidelines. Their faith has crumbled. So they need substitutes. And one of the first things they latch onto is the labeling process. They assign names, and by assigning names, they feel that they have a handle on situations, behaviors, traits, and people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, whatever works. There's nothing wrong with that. In the long term, though, it would be very useful to properly diagnose someone before attempting to cope with that person.
Well, and yet, when you've already made the decision, I'm talking from a victim's perspective. If one's already made the decision to leave because they're living in an impossible situation, how many victims are going to be successful at actually getting their partners that they suspect are narcissistic into treatment or into for evaluation? And if they do get them into evaluation, isn't it going to be more of the person that has these narcissistic characteristics doing a snow job on the psychologist?
Yes, very few would go to treatment, and if they do go to treatment, yeah, they'll try to pull a snow job there. But that's precisely why I suggest to forget for a minute these labels of NPD and not NPD. They are also meaningless. What information does it add? You know that one is NPD or not NPD. It's sufficient to say abuser. One is with an abuser, and one has two acts.
And I think it's just a matter of understanding that it is abuse. I think that's where people have a difficult time, is understanding that, gee, what I went through is abusive. It's not okay. This is what's making
me crazy. People have more than this problem. Many victims develop something that I call malignant optimism. They develop rescue fantasies. They believe that if they change themselves, or if they change the environment, or if they change a set of incentives, or if they change place, they relocate, or if they change a job, or if they change something, they believe that they can ameliorate the situation, or modify the abuse, or control the abuse, or eliminate the abuse. Sometimes it works. Most of the time it does not.
Right.
So this is what I call malignant optimism. This is a set of reactions to abuse. A great many of them, self-delusional. Abuse mm-hmm. victims refuse to admit there's a stage of denial in a grieving process.
Absolutely.
A stage of denial. And during that stage of denial, abuse victims refuse to confront reality that's totally normal and even healthy. A part of that is labeling, as though if one labels one's abuser, one already regained a modicum of control on one's life, which of course is not true. You've mentioned, for instance, that abuse victims leave their abusers. Well, reality is very often the exact opposite. Abusers, unless the abuser agrees to be left alone, the victim would find it close to impossible to leave. The abuser creates such an environment, a cultish environment, which makes it extremely difficult for the victim to go, regardless of whether the victim physically relocates. But there is a continuing presence, even if only in the mind of the victim. There's a continuing presence of the abuser. Stalking is not merely a physical phenomenon.
It's a psychic, in a sense.
It's a psychological phenomenon. It's the abuser invades the mind of the abuse of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
There is a mind snatching operation. It's a mind snatching operation. What abusive conduct, abusive treatment does is condition the victim. It's a Pavlovian reaction, and it's extremely difficult to get rid of it. Extremely difficult. This is why numerous victims of abuse relapse, regress, and reestablish contact with their abusers, although they know very well that this could be even detrimental to their lives and health. It's a tough situation.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It's one of the hardest things that most victims of abuse have to do is to get out of that situation and try to get their power back, I call it.
To let go and be empowered. Yeah,
to get their power back. So it's a pretty crazy situation. One thing I do notice, however, is that there are some commonalities between the abuser or the person with the narcissistic personality disorder and the victim.
And they, sorry?
There are some similarities.
Yeah.
There's actually similarities. Now, one of them is one of the criteria.
Between what and whom? The line was bad, so I couldn't hear. Between
the victim and the abuser.
Oh, right.
For example, the focus on ideal love.
Mm-hmm.
Both are seeking ideal love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what pulls them together in a sense. Don't you agree that desire to find ideal love and everything is so hot and heavy in the beginning?
Yeah.
Because both have somewhat felt that they've met their match. Now do you feel that from your perspective?
Well, there are abusers. They are more of the erotomaniac types. There are abusers that place a high value on finding the fantastic spouse or partner or mate, and they fall in love during the first date and, you know, ask you to marry them the next day and so on and so forth. This type definitely exists, possibly even predominates. But unfortunately, there are other types of abusers. They are far more calculated. They objectify people. They regard people as objects. They derive gratification from the manipulation, control, humiliation, and you know, they play with people. People for them are playthings.
So you don't think that they believe for even a short time that this person has the answer to their happiness? Because aren't people that have NPD, they're searching for happiness too, aren't they?
Well, of course they're searching for happiness. Sadists are very happy when they inflict pain on people. that is the foundation of their happiness. And so I think the typology of abusers is more varied, let's say, than, you know, oh, I found my match and she found her match and now let's get on with it. I think what you're describing is more of the erotomaniac, cultish couple. It's a couple which creates a folie à deux, creates what we call shared psychosis. Yes, creates a shared psychosis, a closed universe, within which each member of the couple constitutes the full answer to the other member's wishes, desires, dreams, fantasies, and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely exists, and I think I would even tend to agree with you that it predominates. However, I have come across cold-blooded predators.
Yeah.
I have come across absent-minded, utterly indifferent predators. Predators who consume you as a victim just because you happen to be there, and they're hungry. They're absent-minded. There's no malice, no evil. They're not evil. They are the equivalent of tigers, you know. They maul you because you're there.
Because you're there.
So I've come across such abusers. I've come across abusers who are sadists. So pain is the foundation of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I've come across abusers who abuse because that inflicts pain on them. It pains them. They're masochists.
Mm-hmm.
And by abusing other people, they feel the fact that they abuse other people justifies their self-image as debased and decrepit characters. And you understand, there are many types of abusers. That's the problem. One of the main problems in dealing with abusers is that you never know. And one coping strategy that works with a certain type of abuser would be utterly counterproductive when used with another type. As concerning victim reactions, we were discussing before, I observed four types, what I call malignant optimism, which is a form of self-delusion, the refusal to believe that some mental health disorders are untreatable, essentially. So malignant optimists, they see signs of hope in every fluctuation. They read meanings and patterns into every thing, utterance. I call it a Pollyanna defense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a rescue fantasy. The victims that develop rescue fantasies are not unaware of the harsh makeup of the abuser. They know that the abuser is, I don't know, chauvinistic, sadistic, his behavior is unacceptable and repulsive and obnoxious. They know all that. They recognize reality. But they also believe in their unlimited transformative capacity. They
Right.
believe that they, with a little application and a lot of love, can straighten out the abuser, rescue the abuser from his own, from wallowing in his own misery.
And I think that happens a lot because the victim actually identifies with the unconscious pain.
Yeah, these people are highly empathic.
Uh-huh.
And they're good people. They're highly empathic and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, they hold unrealistic and I would say even narcissistic perception of their own omnipotence.
Right,
it's actually
yeah.
a narcissistic reaction. They,
well,
they
it's almost a...
Believe,
go ahead.
They actually believe themselves to be omnipotent in some way. And it's a reflection of their own abuser. It's a very complex dynamic and a very interesting one.
Most definitely. And I think there's also in our society that belief that love can heal all.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That is, of course, a narcissistic delusion.
Mm-hmm.
Because it assumes that love is omnipotent, and because anyone and everyone can love, then anyone and everyone is omnipotent. That's a narcissistic delusion. The belief in love is a new thing. It develops in Western society in the last century or two. If you go back in history, romantic love and even love as an emotion were treated much more realistically, let's say, 500 years ago. And were not considered to be omnipotent, on the very contrary. They were considered to be, you know, the victim of circumstances. Then you have self-flagellation. there's a group of victims that attribute to themselves, regard themselves as the reason for the abuse. They justify the abuse. They believe they deserve the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
They always wallow in guilt, self-reproach, self-recrimination, and therefore they use the abuser's conduct as a form of self-punishment. They are masochists in some sense. The abuser fulfills an important ego function for them. And these mostly women, tend to be attracted repeatedly to abusers, especially physical, violent, intimate partners. Physically abusive and violent intimate partners. And they do that because the abuser confirms to them that they are evil, they are bad, they are rotten, you know, and sort of by punishing them, relieves them of anxiety. Again, it's a bit of a complex mechanism.
Yeah, it is very complex. Now, I have one more question. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to ask you this question. In your experience, why do you feel that so many victims of abuse who have researched and studied narcissism come to believe that they might indeed be the narcissist?
Well, this has to do with something called emulation. The psychiatric profession uses the word epidemiology when it describes the personality disorders. There is some belief that personality disorders are in a way communicable diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way they are. The victim feels helpless. The victim feels disempowered. By emulating the abuser, by identifying with the abuser, by becoming an extension of the abuser, the victim reacquires the power of the abuser. This is called the Stockholm syndrome or trauma bonding. It is through identification with the abuser.
You have 1 minute remaining.
It is through identification with the abuser that the victim regains posture and regains power and control over her own life.
Wow, that's impressive. Okay, Sam, we're running out of time. I've just been informed we only have a minute left, and I just want to be sure to thank you for spending this time with us and sharing your wisdom and knowledge that you've gained through all this with us. And where can people go to? Could you just give us your primary website real quick?
Well, it's http://narcissistic-abuse.com, but the best method is simply to type Sam Vaknin into Google.
Okay, yeah, they'll definitely get you that way. So once again, I thank you very much
for
your time. And have a great day.
Take care, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.